Chapter 1. The Unexpected Happens. The night before, on January 18th, 2018, as we were falling asleep, Marshall, my loving husband of 33 years, asked me a question. I found this odd. I was always the one to ask questions after we had already said goodnight. Questions to which Marshall would always respond, "Sleep, my love. We'll talk about it tomorrow." But that night, he asked me a question. "How do you think the book should start?" he asked. He wanted to know how we should begin the book. Our book. The book we had been discussing for months. The book we had our creative and intuitive minds flowing. The book about the afterlife and how to plan your life in the afterlife. I thought about it for a moment then. I told him that I thought it was best to begin the book with my brother's story. My brother Fred, who I loved dearly, had crossed over October 12, 2014. Marshall loved my idea. It seemed only natural to begin there. Our experiences with Fred were really the catalyst for the book. Fred had been ill. Off and on during his illness, we had conversations about the afterlife, what we understood it was like, wondering where we would go when it was our time. So after the death of Fred's physical body, Marshall and I began a series of open communications with him. He was 10 years older than me and my hero, and he loved his little sister. So when Marshall and I set out to find him on the other side, I let my strong love for him guide us to his location. Fred must have been drawn to my memory, and he had, as a teenager, because we found him with Warren, his best friend in high school. The two of them were in what looked like our old neighbor's field. Growing up, Fred and I lived in the country, so we were only a few houses nearby. Warren's family had a farm near our home. My brother would always help Warren milk the cows, feed the chickens, and do other chores that needed to be done. When I first saw them, they were both sitting on top of a hill under the apple tree where they had spent many good times together. Over the next few months, Marshall and I visited Fred many times, had many conversations with him, and helped him in his acclimation. In the process, we learned a great deal, including intimate details about what happens after the death of our physical body. Although we had helped many people cross over the afterlife of their physical bodies, we had never continued contact nor had intimate conversations with them for any length of time. What we learned through our many visits with my brother is incredible. As we reflected on all the things we experienced in these communications, Marshall and I began to realize that there is some specific information in the afterlife that is important to know before bodily death occurs. We also were becoming acutely aware that this information is not readily available to most people. We discovered that preparing before the actual transition and planning your destination in the afterlife are both vitally important to prevent obstacles and hazards that can detain you once you arrive. We came to appreciate the value of our experiential knowledge, and we came to understand that sharing our personal experiences would lessen the burden for others in their time of sorrow. We liked the idea of helping individuals make their ultimate transition easier, without fear. Marshall and I also liked the idea of helping loved ones who are still on Earth find and communicate with their loved ones in the afterlife. Thus, the idea of the book was born. We planned to write this book together. Marshall and I both felt good about our unexpected conversation that night. We went to sleep more excited than ever about our new book. We had already planned our transitions. We wanted to go together. However, if that was not possible, we planned our destination so that we would easily find each other. After our short discussion that night, I got up and wrote a simple note on that writing pad next to my night table. I have done this for years, so information and conversations are not forgotten by morning light. Marshall and I knew that we would be writing this book together on this quiet evening. We did not realize just exactly what that meant. Tragedy unfolds. The morning of January 19th, 2018, was not an ordinary morning by any means. My first thought upon awakening was, I'm gonna die today. I had better get up and get dressed. Without another thought, I got dressed and took our dog, Buddha, a 9-year-old Papillon, for a short walk. When I returned, Marshall was awake, and he met me at our front door, dressed in his long black robe. It was very cold, so he had the hood of his robe over his head. I told him he looked like a monk. He laughed and said he wanted to take Buddha for a short ride in the golf cart to see if they could get up the hill. It had been very cold January in the North Georgia mountains. Bad weather and icy roads kept us in the house bound for days. We were still driving cars without four-wheel drive. Cars were more designed for Florida roads than our steep hills of our home in the mountains. Our driveway is on a steep incline, and our only route to civilization, so to speak. After being held captive by snow and ice for 3 days, Marshall had cabin fever. He was ready to drive up the hill and go somewhere. I kissed him good morning, and he and Buddha left in the golf cart. I went about my morning, but before too long, I heard the doorbell ring. I opened the door and faced the greatest trauma of my life. There stood Marshall. The black hood on his robe was covered in a network of the reddest blood I have ever seen. What little of his white hair I could see was soaked with blood. He looked at me and said, I had a hard time getting Buddha to come back with me. Call an ambulance and tell them I have a headache. I will never forget those words.
Yeah, boy, that's getting me chills. Even hearing it now.
Clearly, he had been injured. Through the blood, I could see a large hematoma growing on his forehead. I ran to the phone. I called my youngest daughter, Kelly, and I told her that Marshall had a horrible accident. Kelly lived the closest, and she drove a four-wheel car that could manage our icy driveway. I emphasized that we needed to get to the hospital as soon as possible. She told me that her Tahoe would be faster than waiting for an ambulance. As we drove up the hill, both of us could see what had happened. As Marshall started up the steep hill, the golf cart immediately slipped on the ice and tumbled off the driveway. Our dog Buddha was thrown to the right side of the snow, and he had injuries. Marshall was thrown to the left side of the driveway into a cluster of sharp bamboo shards that were covered by the accumulated snow. He had suffered blunt force trauma to his head from the initial fall. There was also a large cut on the other side of his head from contact with the sharp bamboo. This was the source of the splattered blood that seemed to be everywhere. We passed the empty golf cart on his side, forlorn and silent. I knew time was of the essence. We had to get Marshall to the hospital as fast as possible. He was in grave danger. Years earlier, Marshall had been prescribed a potent blood-thinning medication ever since his open-heart surgery. A nurse visited our home once a week to monitor his blood pressure. I was frightened for his life, remembering the scare we had several years ago when Marshall had his finger cut on a potato peeler. It took 3 visits to the emergency room and a very clever and creative doctor to stop his bleeding. However, this injury was far worse. I was in the back seat, leaning forward, talking to Marshall as Kelly drove. I was trying to keep him from falling asleep. I was shaking all over. The trauma had only begun. My worst nightmare was just unfolding. When we arrived at the emergency room of our local hospital, the doctors immediately did a brain scan. The emergency room doctor told us the hospital was not equipped to handle Marshall's injury, that it would be necessary to airlift him to Erlanger Hospital in Chattanooga, Tennessee, the closest hospital with a neurosurgeon and with the skills and experience to diagnose the severity of the injury and recommend treatment. Fortunately, the helicopter was sitting in the parking lot of our local hospital. That was most unusual. We were told that it was a 20-minute flight. There was only room in the helicopter for the pilot and patient. Marshall was conscious and talking to us before he left. He kissed me goodbye and said that he would see us when we arrived at Erlanger. Kelly and I watched as his helicopter lifted off the pavement and flew away. We called the other members of the family, shared what had happened, and began the 2-hour drive to Chattanooga. The memory brings me to tears. The terror I felt is still with me. Marshall's son, Steve, was the first to arrive at Erlanger Hospital. Kelly and I arrived a short time after. We were immediately escorted to a private room in the emergency room. A nurse came in and informed us that Marshall had already had a brain scan and indicated that the neurosurgeon would be in shortly to talk with us. None of us were prepared for what the doctor would tell us. The neurosurgeon said that Marshall first arrived. He had thrown up, fallen into a coma, and had been unconscious ever since. We were dumbfounded. He had been talking to me at the local hospital. What had happened in the short time of the helicopter ride, I wondered. The neurosurgeon explained that blood from the injury had gone deep into Marshall's brain. His next words terrified me. The bleeding was on the side of the head that controls speech, movement, and all other physical activities. While the neurosurgeon could perform an operation to repair some of the damage, it was likely that Marshall would be in a vegetative state for the remainder of his life.
Bringing back memories.
I was not prepared for that at all. My first instinct was to approve the operation, rationalizing that if Marshall was meant to cross over, he would do so during the operation. I even toyed with the idea of bringing Marshall home and providing hospice care. Then, after thinking again on the severity of his condition, I realized that this rationalization was really about me, that I was not prepared to let him go.
I'm getting chills with that one.
I was just not ready to believe that this was happening. I was not thinking clearly. The doctor told me to think about the options. He mentioned that we could see Marshall in a short while, but he warned us that Marshall would not be able to communicate with us. He seemed to take forever before I was finally able to see my love. At last, the nurse came in and took us to a different room. Marshall was propped up in a hospital bed. His head hung over to one side. His mouth was slightly open, a breathing tube inserted in his airway. He was unaware that we were there. In that moment when I saw him, my clarity returned. I knew that there would be no operation. I knew that Marshall would not want to be trapped in a body that would not function. The blood had gone deep into Marshall's brain. The damage had been done. And I let the doctor know.
Boy, you get chills with this. Right.
The doctor suggested that we call our family and that we take Marshall to a family comfort room to say our goodbyes. I was not ready to say goodbye to him. Once in the room, the doctor removed Marshall's breathing tube.
Yeah, it's emotional, isn't it?
And put a small plastic tube of oxygen in his nostrils. He said that was for Marshall's comfort.
That's when I laughed.
Oh my God, I could not believe this was happening. When our family had arrived, we sat and talked about the accident. The trip and the doctors and the diagnosis. As I looked around, everything felt surreal to me. The nurse mentioned that Marshall most likely would not make it through the night without the breathing tube. I thought, well, why did they take it out then? I heard the sarcasm in my thought. I could not accept what had happened. I did not want to accept what had happened. We sat all day and most of the night before agreeing to get some rest at a nearby hotel.